Good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable, the programme that brings together people from all different kinds of perspectives for dialogue and debate to bring you conversations that matter every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. I'm your host, Justin Brierley, and if you'd like to find more shows exploring these kinds of dialogues that you're going to be hearing on today's programme, go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There you'll find a whole host of resources, articles, features and videos, and of course links to this year's Unbelievable conference happening on Saturday the 13th of May at the Brewery in London. I hope you can join me as we're joined by world-class Christian apologists and evangelists. Our theme this year, Why Christ? Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe and everything. I'll be launching my new book, which is going to be the very first chance to be able to get your hands on a copy of that. And I'll be speaking at this year's conference as well, alongside people like John Lennox, Andy Bannister, Beth Grove, Jeremiah J. Johnston, Ruth Jackson, Jamie Cutteridge. We've also added to the lineup Sarah Foster of Fanda Apologetics. So really looking forward to Sarah, who was with me for a New Year's Eve edition of the programme earlier in the year. And she's going to be talking again about her interactions with Islam and youth apologetics and that kind of thing. Plus, we've got more speakers to be added to the roster. So if you haven't booked in yet, can I encourage you to do so? There are, of course, group discounts. Two or more tickets gets you a free DVD from last year. And of course, still options on the early bird ticket. But don't leave it too late, because that offer will end from the beginning of March, okay? So get your tickets booked now if you possibly can, or you'll miss the early bird cheaper price. Go to the website premier.org.uk/whyChrist. Right now, it's time to get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking what happened to evolution at the Royal Society. My guests today, Stephen Meyer and Perry Marshall. Now, it didn't make front page headlines across the world, but many biologists are saying that something quite exciting happened at the Royal Society in London last year. Now, the Royal Society is one of the world's oldest and most respected scientific institutions and has been at the forefront, really, of championing the theory of evolution. But at its meeting in November last year, New Trends in Evolutionary Biology, that was the name of the conference, many are saying that the door was opened to potentially alternative explanations for the way life developed from the standard neo-Darwinian explanation of evolution via natural selection acting on random mutation. Dennis Noble, who hosted the conference, brought together leading voices in the so-called third way movement in biology. People like James Shapiro, Sonia Sultan and Gerd Müller, whose research, some people say, has challenged the prevailing orthodoxy. But what does all this mean for the future of evolutionary theory? Does it open the door to things like intelligent design or a role for God in the evolutionary process, or something else entirely? Well, two people who were both there are joining me for Unbelievable today in what I'm sure will be a really interesting scientific, philosophical and theological discussion. Stephen C. Meyer of the Discovery Institute, well known as an advocate of intelligent design theory in books like Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt. In fact, he's been on this programme in the past to debate both of those. Perry Marshall is my other guest. He's the author of Evolution 2.0, a book which gathers much of the research being talked about at this conference, actually, and suggests that the latest research in evolution doesn't support either neo-Darwinism or intelligent design, but what he calls a third way. And I'll let him introduce that when we come to him. But this should be quite an interesting and a first-hand account of what happened at this particular conference and what it might mean. We'll come to Perry in a moment. But before we do that, welcome back to the programme, Dr. Stephen Meyer. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Justin. Thanks for having me. And thanks for having me on with Perry.
Well, the last time I spoke to you, Stephen, was also by phone, shortly before you headed over to the UK to take part in a conference in Cambridge. Now, this fell at around the same time as this Royal Society conference, but you were coming over to be a speaker at a conference in Cambridge around the whole issue of intelligent design. Do you want to just give us a brief idea of how that went and what transpired there?
Yeah, you bet. We had a terrific week in the UK. We were in London. There were about 20 of the scientists from the ID research community worldwide who attended the Royal Society meeting. We had a private research meeting with those scientists, a number of PhD students and postdocs who were European-based the next day to work on collaborative research projects. And then the following Saturday, we had a public conference at one of the Cambridge colleges, Hughes Hall, called Beyond Materialism, where we were looking at what biology looks like if you don't start with the assumption of methodological naturalism or materialism, and making the case for intelligent design across a number of subdisciplines of biology, showing how intelligent design provides superior explanatory power to a number of the phenomena that we're looking at, whether in the fossil record or genomics or at the level of molecular and cell biology. So it was quite a stimulating week. So, yeah, we had a great time.
It sounds like you did. Do you think that there is sort of a groundswell of support for intelligent design in the UK?
There's quite a number of both senior researchers who are working on ID-based research projects, some of which we're supporting, and a number of younger people who are at the PhD and postdoc level. And so I would say worldwide, including in the UK, there's a growing interest. Part of it is, of course, derivative of the growing openness in evolutionary biology itself to alternative approaches, which was in evidence at the Royal Society meeting and is the reason we're talking this morning.
Well, let's move on to the Royal Society, because I can imagine in those particular halls, the term intelligent design is almost seen as a dirty word. So what is it they're actually talking about? How do you think it all plays into your particular field of expertise?
Right. You kindly have had me on before to talk about Darwin's Doubt, the book that I published in 2013 and 14. And in the prologue to that book, I made a statement that some people found provocative, but I said that rarely has there been such a great disparity between the popular perception of a theory, and I was talking about neo-Darwinism, and its actual standing in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And I made the claim that if you look closely at the technical literature in biology, what you find is world-class biologists expressing very openly doubts about especially the creative power of the central mechanism of neo-Darwinism, the mutation natural selection mechanism. And this has been going on for quite some time. And yet when the theory is presented publicly or to the public in policy statements by august scientific bodies like the American Association for the Advancement of Science or up until now, the Royal Society on your side of the Atlantic, or by popularizers of science like Richard Dawkins or Jerry Coyne, neo-Darwinism is still presented to the public as a theory which is beyond doubt, indubitable. And nothing could be further from the truth as you look at the actual scientific literature, not just in biology generally, but in the relevant subdiscipline of evolutionary biology. What was extraordinary about the meeting at the Royal Society in November is that many of the scientists who have been raising concerns about neo-Darwinism in the peer-reviewed scientific literature were allowed to do so in a public forum that garnered quite a lot of attention in the scientific press, and now it's beginning to percolate through even into the popular press. And so I think really the question that arises out of the Royal Society meeting is, after Darwin or after neo-Darwinism, what next? And because I really think the theory is dead. There are very few technical defenders of the theory. Jerry Coyne will still weigh in to defend. There was a man, Douglas Fatuma, who's written a popular textbook in the United States, an old-line neo-Darwinist there, raising objections to the proceedings. But if you look at what's going on in the technical literature in evolutionary biology, evolutionary theory, there are very few defenders of neo-Darwinism. It was, after all, back in 1980 that Stephen Jay Gould said that neo-Darwinism is dead, except as textbook orthodoxy. And I think that's ever more evident today, especially after this very important conference.
Well, we're going to dig into that a little bit more. Thank you for joining us on the line to talk about your experience of being there and what you think it means for the future of science and biology. Perry, welcome back to the program. How are you doing?
I'm great. It's great to be here on your show from Chicago, and it's an honor to be talking about the Royal Society meeting.
Yeah, so it must have been quite fun going along to this august institution. What did you make of it, just as, you know, in general? What was your reaction to walking these particular halls and being there in person?
Well, if you didn't really know the background, you didn't really know what was going on, you would go there and you would say, well, okay, so what's new? So scientists are disagreeing about stuff. But if you are in the field and you understand it deeply and you can read the tea leaves, it was the Protestant Reformation of evolutionary biology. I mean, like this would have never happened 5 years ago. And it speaks to a sea change that's going on. In fact, to just, you know, to continue the metaphor, Dennis Noble pounded his theses on the door and said, hey, this dog don't hunt. And neo-Darwinism is really in serious trouble. It's past its expiration date. And it's no longer enough to just, wave a little magic wand and say natural selection. Because what living things do is so amazing, and they do it in real time. I mean, this is the thing, is evolution has traditionally been this very, millions and millions of years of explanation, and you need all of this time, when in fact, Sonia Sultan, maybe we can get to this later, but she told about plants adapting in just literally real time and passing immediate changes to their progeny in one generation. And so if you understand that evolution is a constant 24/7, 365 feedback between the environment and the organism, and the changes in some cases are passed immediately, then you have this completely different view of evolution. And I felt like Forrest Gump being there and watching this happen, because I understood what was going on. It was really amazing.
Well, that's the thing. Two different people can take away very different impressions, I suppose, of these things. And what may have been to someone a sort of slightly, dusty, dry academic discussion, for you, as you say, it feels like this has been a revolution, quite literally. And you say that this couldn't have happened 5 years ago. I mean, what's changed in 5 years to mean that suddenly the orthodox view of neo-Darwinism is being questioned in this way?
Well, I was talking to Ava Yablanka, who's she's a very respected researcher from Israel, who is kind of part of the third way movement. And she said, I've been fighting these guys for a long time. And she really has. I mean, she's been kind of a heretic to the old school neo-Darwinist guys. But she said, look, it's one thing if one person like me is saying epigenetics is a big deal. But it's another thing if the nutrition people are talking about it, and the fitness people are talking about it, and the cancer people are talking about it, and on. And this, epigenetics is become a household word in the people into fitness and health and all that kind of stuff, because the genome is very dynamic, and you don't, like, your genes don't have to change. Epigenetics is like, it's like software menus that get grayed out and switch certain things on and off, and then something changes, and then that grayed out thing gets switched back on, and this is what happens. And so, like, it's not just one thing. It's this pop culture thing I referred to. It's also the fact that we're now sequencing genomes all over the place, and we're seeing more and more clearly what goes on. And frankly, even just basic practice of medicine, fighting disease, fighting cancer, tumors, all that kind of stuff, requires a completely different view of evolution than what the neo-Darwinists have always told us. And Dennis Noble, the organizer of the conference, he's a physiologist, and he's super famous in the medical field for making the pacemaker possible. And his heart research, when they were figuring out how the cardiac rhythm works, he figured out, from knocking out genes and seeing how it affected the behavior of the heart, he figured out empirically there's no way the neo-Darwinist version of how genes work is true. And so it's been the fact that the outsiders, the voices of people on the outside of evolutionary biology, have gotten louder and louder. And the irony is that evolutionary biology itself, the core of the field, has been the most resistant to evolving their knowledge of biology of anybody, which is, kind of funny, I think, but it's true.
Yeah. We're going to come back to you in a moment, Steve, because first things first, we should really just define what this current orthodoxy that's being overturned, in your view, is when it comes to the neo-Darwinian view of evolution. And then we'll get into some of the issues around intelligent design and obviously Perry's take on all of this. And also what some of the, you know, the old school are saying, the atheists like Dawkins and Coyne, they're saying, actually, this conference proved absolutely nothing. You know, our neo-Darwinian worldview is still perfectly intact. So we'll be coming back to some of these questions. And if you'd like to perhaps give your thoughts on anything you hear on today's program, you're very welcome to email in. I know that these issues, especially when we've got people like Perry and Stephen Meyer on the phone, always provoke a lot of interest and reaction. So wherever you stand on this, I'd be interested to hear from you. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send me an email. I'll try and read it out on next week's program. You can find us online as well, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Leave a comment underneath today's program, or indeed find your way to the Facebook and Twitter account at UnbelievableJB or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB and get in touch that way. Tell me what you think about our subject today on the programme. We're asking, what exactly happened to evolution at the Royal Society last November?
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So as we continue this conversation, Steve, neo-Darwinian evolution, can you kind of quickly define that and again, quickly explain why, in your view, so much of the research from this so-called third way movement in biology is overturning that particular paradigm?
Well, neo-Darwinian evolution is the evolutionary theory that relies mainly on the mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations, and asserts that that mechanism has the creative power, virtually unlimited creative power, to make the transformations that are described by Darwin's great tree of life. So it has two parts. The historical part is the sometimes referred to as the pattern of the tree, which describes the idea of universal common descent, that all organisms are descended from a single common ancestor, and that the branching tree of life was produced by the mechanism of natural selection acting on adaptively random genetic variations. And that's the process part. So the process and the pattern together form neo-Darwinian theory, the process being the mechanism of mutation and selection, and the pattern being the Darwinian tree, which depicts the history of life suggesting that all organisms are related by common ancestry. What was really interesting to me at the conference was that the opening talk by Gerd Müller, who's one of the leading developmental biologists and also evolutionary biologists, was very clear in laying out what he called the explanatory deficit of neo-Darwinism, sometimes called the modern synthesis, because it synthesized the Mendelian genetics with Darwinian evolutionary theory. And he said there were three key explanatory deficits. One was the origin of phenotypic complexity, the phenotype being the expression of the genes, so in actual anatomical structures, so things like the origin of eyes, ears, and the whole body plans or body architectures of animals in particular. The other thing he said was an explanatory deficit was the origin of phenotypic novelty, genuine complex organisms, and then new forms of organisms like bats, which would have echolocation or interesting anatomical innovations. And then thirdly was what he called the non-gradual forms or modes of transition, that is referring to the abrupt appearance of major new body plans and modes of biological organization in the fossil record. So those were the three things that sort of defined the crisis in neo-Darwinism. We can't account for complexity, we can't account for novelty, and we don't know why things emerge so abruptly in the fossil
and
record.
This is the drum you've been banging yourself for a long time, especially obviously in the book Darwin's Doubt. That's specifically majors on the fact that, you know, these sudden body plans emerge relatively quickly in the course of history, in things like the Cambrian explosion and so on. So I guess you've been following this evidence for a long time yourself, but this is the first time you're seeing it genuinely kind of put on the table in this kind of a setting, is it?
in this kind of a public conference setting. It's been publicly expressed in the scientific literature now for quite a while. So I think it was refreshing. And I think Terry and I shared this view, that all this is suddenly public. I would qualify a little bit the way you phrased the question. I don't think what's driving this is the third way mechanisms that are being proposed, and whether those mechanisms solve these problems that were laid out by Mueller is, I think, a very important question to address, because I don't think they did or do. But I think what's driving it is actually the phenomena of biology itself, the fossil record certainly, but also the kinds of things we're learning about the primacy of information, digital information stored in the DNA, and other forms of information, epigenetic forms of information, that are necessary to build a new body plan. So if you want to build something that's fundamentally new, an anatomical innovation, a novelty, you've got to have a lot of new information of various kinds to do that. And the mutation selection mechanism does not seem to have that creative power for a whole bunch of reasons. One that's, I think, quite intuitive to most people with a computer background: if you've got a section of functioning code and you start randomly changing the zeros and ones, you're going to degrade that information long before you ever get to a new operating system or program. And yet neo-Darwinism is essentially saying that random changes in a section of digital information can generate the new information you would need to build new structures and okay. new forms of life. And I think for lots of reasons, people don't think that's credible.
Okay. I'd be interested in bringing you in at this point, Perry, to just say, obviously, what Stephen is saying is, it's great that they're pointing out the problems. We've been seeing those problems all along as well. Not sure that their answers, though, are up to much, that are coming from the third way, as they're called, biologists, people like James Shapiro. Now, I know you've certainly looked at his work a great deal, and others too. Do you think that what is being proposed in terms of alternatives to neo-Darwinian mechanisms are valid kind of ways of looking into it, and whether the apparent intelligence in things like the cell and so on can be explained that way?
I think they are a really good start. I would refer you to a guy named David Prescott, who Jim Shapiro talks about in his work. And Prescott put a protozoan under stress, and it spliced its DNA into 100,000 pieces, rearranged it, and made significant changes to its physiology in a matter of hours. Or, for example, experiments on symbiogenesis, where they actually have gotten microorganisms to merge in real time. So a cell inside a cell. So symbiogenesis is, for example, it's the theory that the chloroplast, which every kid learns about in biology school, is actually a blue-green algae. That's merged with a plant cell. It's like a Starbucks inside a Marriott hotel lobby, if you will. And they've done experiments where they've gotten cells to merge together like this. Now, if you stop and think about what's really going on, you can't drop a Starbucks out of a helicopter onto the roof of a Marriott, and have a beautiful coffee shop in the lobby the next day. There's a tremendous amount of choreography that has to happen between all the parts. And what we see is that living things actually do this. I think these mechanisms that the third way people are advocating, which in my book, Evolution 2.0, I refer to as the evolutionary Swiss Army knife, I think these mechanisms go a long way in explaining this. And I would only make one caveat and ask for one element of amnesty on this, because you can always find something that we haven't explained very well at this point. And I would just say, well, part of the problem is that evolutionary biology has been operating on the wrong set of rails for 70 years, and 90% of the scientists have been looking in the wrong places or just making up stories about natural selection to kind of fig leaf hide their inability to explain things. And I think now we're actually getting on the right track.
What's your problem, and just a couple of minutes before we have to go to a break, then, with with Stephen's perspective, which I understand you don't go down the road of, which is, well, there's evidence of some kind of design inference here, that these kind of systems and so on have to have information at a very detailed level put into the system from outside in some way. Do you not sort of go with that kind of particular way of looking at things?
10 years ago, I would have been solidly in Stephen's camp. In fact, I would say that I was. I gave a fairly famous talk called "If You Can Read This, I Can Prove God Exists," and I think I've, you know, got as good of a God of the Gaps argument as anybody, which is DNA's code, all the other codes are designed, therefore DNA is designed. And I even have a $3 million technology prize for solving this, which is a very serious prize, and we really are looking for a solution. I used to use this as a God of the Gaps argument. I am very reluctant to do that now. And the reason why is because gaps keep getting solved. And every time a gap gets solved, you know, if you were believing in God for that particular reason, all of a sudden the rug got pulled under your out from under your feet. But the other thing is every time one of these gaps gets solved, the universe itself becomes more elegant than it was before. There's a very important story where Isaac Newton worked out his math of all the planets, and he said, well, my math says that they're going to go off course after a period of time, so I guess God probably pushes them back in place. And Laplace came along later, and he fixed the math, and like, no, you don't need God to push the planets back in place. You just didn't quite have this right. And I'm very reluctant to do God of the Gaps when, in fact, living things in the universe and everything, it is so remarkable. It still demands an ultimate explanation, but I feel that the Intelligent Design Discovery Institute approach conflates immediate mechanisms with ultimate explanations in a way that's not very helpful. And I want to read you an email I got from a scientist that illustrates this. He said, "We both see the fault in the current paradigm. The art is to convince the biomedical research community that there's a better way. I've been struggling with this issue more than 15 years now, publishing and chairing meetings both in the US and Europe. And my own sense is that there's fear in the group that if they blink on the subject of Darwinian evolution, the ID people will literally and figuratively eat their lunch. So the task is to switch to another paradigm while sustaining the existing one." And he sent me that a couple years ago. But I think that summarizes what the typical working evolutionary scientist feels is a threat to them doing their job.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to let Stephen respond, because you've said you don't take, you know, the same approach that the Discovery Institute and people like Steve Maier take, and I'd like to hear his response on this as well. And again, I'll make sure to give the ways for you to get in touch if you're listening and you'd like to respond to anything you hear on today's programme. We're asking what exactly happened to evolution at the Royal Society at this conference in November that was titled New Trends in Evolutionary Biology. Continuing to talk to two experts in the area, Stephen Maier and Perry Marshall.
How can I know it's true?
What about other religions?
Why Christ? Join me, Justin Brierley, to find answers at Unbelievable The Conference 2017. Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything, and how to share him with others. Plus, I'll be launching my new book and sharing why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists. It's in London on Saturday the 13th of May with great speakers, including Professor John Lennox, Beth Grove, Andy Bannister, and Jeremiah J. Johnston of our conference partner, the Christian Thinkers Society. Early bird tickets are available now at premier.org.uk/whychrist.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Unbelievable, brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. If you want to get a free sample copy of the mag, then do go online to premierchristianity.com/freesample. Always loads of interesting features interviews, articles, news, culture, and much more besides. All brought to you as part of Faith Explored here every Saturday on Premier Christian Radio. And if you want to get in touch, I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch in a little while. Lots of people leave their thoughts every week, and you can do the same. And we'll be hearing towards the end of today's show what you had to say about some recent editions of the programme. Don't forget that straight after Unbelievable, you can hear another edition of The Profile. Someone in some walk of faith and life will be sharing their story between 4 and 5 this afternoon. Right now, we're talking about evolution, biology, Christianity, and whether there's a new paradigm emerging. What happened to evolution at the Royal Society last November? Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute, well known as an advocate of intelligent design theory, joins me. His books Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt have already been debated on this programme. Perry Marshall is the author of Evolution 2.0, and in many ways is very enthusiastic about what happened at the Royal Society. This was a meeting which really put forward and put to the test and was a discussion and conversation on whether other ways of understanding evolution compared to the traditional, if you like, orthodox neo-Darwinian perspective might have something in them. Stephen, in that last section, Perry's saying for his money, he doesn't go down the route you take, the intelligent design route. He says in the end, for him, it kind of is a God of the gaps type of argument. But when you close a gap, your argument for God goes away. And in a way, you know, there's something to be said for the elegance of what is being discovered more and more in nature, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's just random and you know, but that there's something very interesting and peculiar going on. What's your take on this? Because obviously for you do think that intelligent design is the best of the explanations out there for what increasingly people in the secular scientific world are discovering.
Yeah, absolutely. And we think the elegance that's being discovered in living systems is evidence of design. And we don't think it's a God of the gaps argument. It's mind as the best explanation based on our experience argument. We're not arguing for intelligent design based on what we don't know, but what we do know about the cause and effect structure of the world, namely that large infusions of new information always come from intelligent agents, whether we're talking about a computer program or a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book. Information is known in our experience to be produced by one and only one type of cause, and that is an intelligent agent. Interestingly, Perry makes this same argument in his book, and it's a wonderful part of the book. He lays out the case that all codes are created by conscious mind, and therefore the code in DNA must have been created by a conscious mind. He makes that point on page 192 of his book, and that section of the book I agree with very much. In fact, that is a design argument. It's not a God of the gaps argument. So what he's offering, I think, is not so much a third way, but rather a hybrid. He's comfortable making the case for mind as the best explanation of the code in DNA at the point of the origin of the first life. But when it comes to biological evolution as opposed to chemical evolution, he thinks that these third way mechanisms are sufficient or promising enough that we ought not consider design as an explanation after the point of the first life. I part company there, and I'd like to explain why, because I also think that Shapiro's work is extremely interesting, and it's certainly cutting it's cutting some new ground in biology. Shapiro was talking about this, and I discussed Shapiro's work and five of the other third way mechanisms that have been proposed, non neo-Darwinian mechanisms of evolutionary change, in Darwin's Doubt in two of the key chapters in the book. And what I show there is that invariably what's going on is that these new mechanisms either presuppose unexplained sources of information, or they simply don't explain the origin of necessary information to get real anatomical novelty. In other words, there's limits on what these mechanisms can produce. So take Shapiro's work. He's describing ways in which organisms respond in real time to environmental stresses and then produce a response in the way that either they express pre-existing genetic information or the way they ramp up the mutation rate in very specific parts of the genome to explore possibilities that are already latent in that genetic information. So what he's talking about is a kind of pre-programmed adaptive capacity, which he says is under algorithmic control. That's all extremely cool, and it is very elegant the way organisms can do that. But the question that Shapiro doesn't address is, where does the pre-programming come from? Where does that algorithm come from? There's a higher level of informational programming at work that's presupposed in this whole process that he doesn't attempt to explain. And my concern about using this as an explanation for the whole of what we see in biological evolution is twofold. First, you can't really propose that all this information that is in all these different organisms, and every organism has its own pre-programming to respond in different ways according to its organismal needs. I don't think it's plausible to say that all this information could have been front-loaded in the circular chromosome of a bacterial cell at the point of the origin of life. Clearly, you're going to need additional information at discrete points along the biological timeline. Just getting from prokaryotes to eukaryotes requires an extensive reworking of the whole system of storage of genetic information. But secondly, and this is, I think, really a key thing, because this is one of the key problems, it is the problem of epigenetic information. Not all the information necessary to build a body plan is in DNA. DNA codes for building proteins, but proteins have to be organized into biosynthetic pathways that would characterize different kinds of cells and cell types. Different cell types have to be organized into different tissues. Different tissues have to be organized into different organs, and organs and tissues have to be organized into whole body plans. And the information for doing that is not solely in the DNA. Higher levels of information stored elsewhere are required to organize all those different levels of the biological hierarchy. And Shapiro is focusing on natural genetic engineering. And as such, he might get the new proteins out of this, but he's not going to explain the origin of body plans. And that's the really crucial question in biological evolution. Where does that higher level innovation come from? So I don't think these mechanisms really solve those problems. And in fact, I think in principle, they're not sufficient to do so, because they don't account for this higher level of organization that's necessary.
Just before we come back to Perry, this email he received, which said basically they don't want to open a door to intelligent design. They're going to kind of keep in the textbooks, the neo-Darwinian version, until they've worked out what's going on, you know, in reality, in the scientific research and everything. What's your take?
Well, absolutely. But that's a statement of metaphysical panic. They don't want to consider something that would take them outside of a naturalistic framework. And that, by the way, that same panic was in evidence at the meeting. At one point, Eva Jablonka was under pressure from one of the old line neo-Darwinists in her talk. And the neo-Darwinist said, no, we don't need to consider these alternatives. And Eva said, unprompted, she says, I'm not talking about God, as if anyone had raised God as a possibility. So God was the elephant in the room.
Yes.
But terror of an alternative perspective that you don't like for metaphysical reasons is not a scientific justification for claims about the creative power of mechanisms that have not yet demonstrated that creative power. We need actual demonstrations. I agree with Perry that this is really cool stuff.
Okay.
And I do think it speaks to the incredible elegance of organisms, but I don't think it solves the problem of macroevolution.
Okay, let me come to you again, Perry. Firstly, do you agree that sort of God was the elephant in the room? Were people desperate, both in the third wave camp and in the kind of traditional camp, not to make sure that no one gets wind of any idea that we're talking about anything supernatural here? And then we'll come on to talk about what Stephen had to say about your particular way of looking at these issues.
There were a few moments where you got that impression, and definitely the elephant in the room showed up a couple of times. For the most part, that wasn't the case, because I don't think that's actually what's on most people's minds. So when this scientist sends me this email, see, I think that the Discovery Institute pits theology against science in an unnecessary way, and we kind of have to pull apart two different issues. There's origin of life versus origin of species. Now, origin of life, the truth is, there's not a lot that you can say about it that properly qualifies as science. It's like a big freaking mystery. And we can come back to that later if you want. But what the conference was about was, where does all this new stuff come from? Now, if you look at things like horizontal gene transfer and epigenetics purely as mechanisms, and if you think of them the way that you think of how a computer operates, Stephen is right. However, there's something that I want everyone to consider, and it's this. So, Stephen, a lot of people in the intelligent design community are information theorists. Well, so am I. I wrote an Ethernet book. Now, if you want to create new information, here's what you have to do. You have to be able to choose between two things, and it has to be a choice, not a random accident. And so I'll give you an example. If I have an existing dictionary, if I use random processes or just computer algorithms, I can't really produce brand new language. However, on the autofill on my phone, I can text my brother, and right away when I open the text thing, it says I, you, yes, and I can put you, and then can, are, should, and I can put should, and then be, do, talk, you should talk. Now, if I choose between those choices based on the environment, I can create novel information and novel structures. I would propose to you that a cell is something like a quantum computer with a linguistic engine, and it can respond to the environment and create something new that never existed before, because it is not merely a mechanism. It is a self that is doing what it needs to do to maintain homeostasis and to survive and to thrive and to do whatever, to eat lunch or whatever it's trying to do. And I think this is what has been overlooked. Now, this is going to make a neo-Darwinist extremely uncomfortable, but if you look at what cells do, if you look at what living things do, it's obvious that they're doing something like this. And I would like to suggest to you that if a protozoan can rearrange its DNA into 100,000 pieces and not only still work, but actually be better off than it was before, and if it can do that in 12 hours, then what can happen in 10 years or 20 years or a million years? And so this is the approach that I think we should be taking with the Cambrian, because if somebody says, I can't explain it, I can't explain the Cambrian, God did it, let's go take a 3-martini lunch, a scientist can't get a paycheck for saying that. Scientists are never running out of layers of the onion to peel. And so I think jumping all the way to the elephant in the room is a problem. I think having God as an ultimate explanation, why are the equations symmetrical? Why is all of this elegant? I think that's a much better way to use God, and it's more in keeping with the way the classical scientists, Maxwell and Copernicus and Gal, it's closer to how they viewed God.
Do you want to respond to that, Stephen?
Yeah, well, first, Perry's own way of describing the process was revealing. He said, if I choose based on environmental conditions, I can create novel information. And all these computer simulations that are used to demonstrate the creative power of various evolutionary mechanisms invariably do so because of programming that's been supplied in advance by the chooser, by the intelligent programmer. And so the kind of things that organisms are doing in the Shapiro-type demonstrations are, by Shapiro's own accounting of these, under algorithmic control. There's a pre-programming there. It's not that I'd be very reluctant to go down a kind of nature mysticism and attribute higher order a conscious agency, let alone almost omniscience about environment, to a protist. And so I think that's something that we really need to caution against. Secondly, we're not pitting science versus theology. We're saying that science and good science points to design, and therefore science may have implications that are friendly to theology. But this isn't a theology-based argument, and we're not arguing for God. We're arguing for evidence of an intelligent agency or mind based on our uniform and repeated experience. That is to say, based on the same method of scientific reasoning that Darwin himself used in The Origin, which is to look at our present knowledge of cause and effect and see what that tells us about what the most plausible explanation for the causes of events in the past might be. Our present knowledge of cause and effect affirms, whether it's in computer simulations of the generation of information or origin of life simulations, you need a mind to generate new information. So I think that's not what we're doing. Thirdly, as far as the scientists deriving their paychecks, the most important obligation that the scientist has is to find the truth. And it is simply so we want to find the truth first and foremost. But as a matter of the heuristic value of different scientific approaches, we think intelligent design has tremendous heuristic value. That is to say, it can lead to new discoveries. If you infer that design was at work or an intelligence was at work in producing a system, you're going to look at it differently. For example, we predicted very early on that the junk DNA was not junk. And we did that on the basis of an ID perspective. The Neo-Darwinians thought that the non-coding regions of the genome were the natural and expected expected result of random changes accumulating, the flotsam and jetsam of the evolutionary process accumulating over time. It was just what they expected, that 3% would be functional and the rest would be the residual of that trial and error process. We, from an ID perspective, said the opposite. Look, we accept that mutations are real processes, but we wouldn't expect that the signal should be dwarfed by the noise. And so we expect to find function in that allegedly non-functional region, that vast allegedly non-functional region of the genome. And lo and behold, over the last 10 years, and especially with the publication of the ENCODE project, that ID perspective has been borne out. And in fact, Jim Shapiro, one of the scientists who was writing on this, gave credit to Richard Sternberg, formerly of the Smithsonian, one of our ID colleagues, for being the first guy to see this. And he did so in the Huffington Post, of all places. So that's just one of many examples where ID has heuristic value. It anticipates certain, if you think a system is a design system, you're going to get in, you're going to look at it, you're going to try to figure out what is the functional logic? What should I be expecting to find here that's going to make this work in accord with a rational plan?
Okay.
And so we think this is a science stopper, it's a science starter.
We'll leave that just there for the moment. I do want to, accepting that obviously I'm sure Perry would want to come back on that, maybe we'll get time later on. I do at least want to bring in the perspective given by someone who does still hold to the neo-Darwinian perspective on evolution. Jerry Coyne wrote a blog on the conference in which he concluded by saying modern evolutionary theory is not in trouble, far from it. Maybe sometime a new paradigm will come around, but this isn't it. The noise we heard from London, outside a few papers by people like Futuyama, who I think is a sort of in line with Coyne's view, is the noise of Templeton's prize horses jockeying for money and fame. He's got a thing about it's all the Templeton Fund who are basically, you know, funding the people who are putting these alternative theories forward. But just to pull out some of what he actually says in the blog, to kind of back up his points, he says, for instance, when it comes to plasticity, which is this idea of organisms adapting in real time to their environment, which, you know, you've been saying, Perry, is a classic example of the way the Neo-Darwinian paradigm can't account for these things. He says, as is well known, organisms can change their appearance, behaviour and physiology depending on their environment. Some of this is simply a shock response with no adaptive value, while other forms of plasticity are evolved adaptations that reside in the DNA. Cats grow longer fur when it's cold. Rotifers develop predator-deterring spines when put in water with fish odor, etc. But the new paradigmists say that non-adaptive plasticity can actually initiate an adaptive evolutionary change. It's really not clear how this would happen. So, and I've heard the similar kind of thing from others saying this doesn't show Neo-Darwinian evolution is false. It just shows that there's stuff going on. There's stuff in the, you know, in the organism that's ready to adapt when it happens. But that very ability to adapt is a result of this neo-Darwinian process that makes them suitable for being able to adapt quickly in that kind of real-time way. All you're seeing then is, as he says it later, he kind of gives an example of a conversation that took place between, I think, Dennis Noble and David Shuker, where Shuker says of a particular experiment that the conclusion of the experiment was the scientist saying, our results demonstrate that natural selection can rapidly rewire regulatory networks. So it's a perfect, beautiful example of rapid neo-Darwinian evolution. So a lot to get your head round there, and I hope those at home were following along. But essentially, it boils down to people like Jerry Coyne, who absolutely disavow anything that might even smell of something supernatural, and I think they think that this stuff smells a bit supernatural, saying it can all be accounted for in the end by what we've always known and loved, which is the neo-Darwinian synthesis.
Natural selection only explains that things die. When somebody says natural selection rewired that microorganism, that is a non-explanation. Somebody explain to me how natural selection rewires a bunch of genes. And by the way, he's talking about an experiment where they deleted the genes for a bacterial flagellum. 4 days later, the organism had rebuilt those genes, presumably by restructuring information from the regulatory networks, and they grew tails and they went back to swimming and finding food. They did this in 4 days. Well, what a neo-Darwinist will always say is, oh, yeah, well, natural selection did that. Oh, yeah, natural selection did that. Well, natural selection is not a creative mechanism. Natural selection is when things die and other things stay alive. That's it. This is what they do. And so, yes, it's not clear how. And so the neo-Darwinists want it to be, well, randomness did that. Randomness does not do this. I'm an electrical engineer. I know this, okay? Then on the other side, you have, well, God did that. But when you come to something like the Cambrian, you come down to either God injected new species or new information and did some kind of a divine thing, or the organisms, because cells are in some sense intelligent, the organisms did this. Okay, well, the thesis of evolution 2.0 is Darwinists underestimate nature and creationists underestimate God. And I would put the ID Discovery Institute crowd in that same. I think, Stephen, I propose to you, you're underestimating what life is capable of and whether life itself is a literal divine miracle or if it's actually the way it is because the universe is tuned to a million decimal places instead of 120, like, whichever explanation it is, I really think, Stephen, that you're underestimating nature and you're doing so in a way that takes a job away from a scientist.
Go ahead, Stephen.
No, you're oversimplifying. Yeah, investigative journalists are told to follow the money. Biological scientists, computer scientists interested in biology need to follow the information. The reason these changes can happen so quickly was alluded to in Perry's own words. He talked about the restructuring of the information in the regulatory network. That doesn't happen magically. It's not happening randomly. Shapiro is right. If it were happening randomly, it would take a whole lot longer than it's happening. The only reason it can happen that quickly is that there is pre-existing programming, pre-existing algorithmic control, pre-existing information that's making that restructuring possible in response to an algorithmic if-then subroutine. The organism gets a signal from the environment. It says, I need to restructure my genome in accord with the needs I have for survival. That ability to do that is pre-programmed. And that's the locus of the design inference. Where does that pre-programming come from? It's not mysticism. It's not magic. There must be information there. So the locus of design for us is the origin of that, the information that makes that process possible. And Shapiro doesn't address that question, and Perry doesn't either. And for that reason, I don't think we have a third way here. I think we just have people who are not addressing the fundamental question of the origin of information after the key question of the origin of life. I love what Perry says about the origin of life. It's absolutely right. But that question of the origin of information doesn't go away in as you ascend up the biological hierarchy. There are new informational needs if you're going to account for the origin of new organs, tissues, complex molecular machines, and especially whole body plants, such as you find in the Cambrian. And I would again repeat the point that you can't get higher level body plan structure out of genetic information alone. And so when you have these mechanisms like horizontal gene transfer or natural genetic engineering, they're not going to give you that level of complexity. At best, they're going to give you some new proteins. And so there are real limits to what these mechanisms can do. They're demonstrable. It's really cool science. I agree that it is a necessary emendation to neo-Darwinism. I understand why Coyne and others are upset because they are being passed by, but I don't think the third way solves the information problem. And that's not a matter of God of the gaps or anything else. It's a matter of doing some fundamental science and tracing the information flows. If you trace them back to your source, you get the singularities where no evolutionary mechanism accounts for the origin of the programming that's necessary.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with the final part of this discussion today. Really interesting discussion. Dr. Stephen Meyer, who is, of course, part of the Discovery Institute and one of the leading voices in intelligent design theory, talking about this recent Royal Society conference that happened here in London. Has it overturned the neo-Darwinian view of evolution? It is the beginning of a revolution, as far as my other guest, Perry Marshall, is concerned as well. Now, my guests, though, disagreeing on what the essential implications of that are for intelligent design theory, or whether there are other ways of explaining the origin of these adaptive features of nature and cells and so on. Perry Marshall's book, Evolution 2.0, very much along those lines. And we'll be hearing him again defend his thesis that you don't have to go down the intelligent design route to see that there is an elegance and there's something ultimately that maybe derives from God, but not in a strictly direct way. I'll be interested in pressing into that a bit with you in a minute, Perry, as well. And and we'll see what you have to say as well. Don't forget your thoughts are welcome as well in regards to what you hear on today's programme. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to reading out some of your emails about recent shows towards the end of today's show as well. Come back for part three in just a moment.
Deliver us from evil. In the February edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we open up the real-life world of exorcism and deliverance ministry, separating fact from the Hollywood fiction of demonic possession. We also talk to the world's most influential Bible scholar, N.T. Wright, on why he's returning to the revolutionary cross of Christ. You'll learn about the six lies our worship music tells us and how we can fix them. And we'll hear from the family law court judge delivering his evidence on why we need to save marriage for the good of the UK. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Unbelievable is the show that brings you conversations every week between people from different perspectives on the theological spectrum, and also, of course, debates between Christians and non-Christians as well. Thank you for joining me this Saturday afternoon. And don't forget, if you're interested in the kinds of issues we debate on the programme, you might be interested in picking up a copy of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm the senior editor of that monthly title, and it brings you a whole range of news, cultural issues, interviews, features, reviews, and much more besides. You can get a free sample copy of the latest February edition at premierchristianity.com/freesample, or indeed, if you're listening to this at a later date on podcast, it'll bring you whatever the latest edition of the magazine is, and there's always exciting stuff in every single edition. Going to be telling you about another Christian and skeptic discussion group that's kicked off recently as a bit of an outgrowth from Unbelievable, so I'll be bringing you that. Some greetings from listeners from all over the world, and of course some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. Next week, if you can come back, we're going to be discussing Hinduism and Christianity. Was Jesus just another spiritual guru? Like Krishna, Ken Samples has a new book out called God Among Sages. He'll be in conversation with Deepan Rajagopalan of the Hindu Council, so that'll be an interesting one. And if you can stay after Unbelievable today between 4 and 5, my guest is Becky Pippert, the author of the best-selling book Out of the Salt Shaker, and she's going to be talking about her life as an international evangelist and as a mum. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 if you can stick around this Saturday afternoon.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, concluding our conversation today, really fascinating one, digging into a recent event that took place in London. What happened to evolution at the Royal Society? Stephen Meyer and Perry Marshall have joined me on the programme today. Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute, well known as an advocate of intelligent design theory. Perry Marshall, author of Evolution 2.0, a book which very much delves into some of the issues we've been uncovering around whether the neo-Darwinian framework for evolution has been kind of finally upended by the work of people like James Shapiro, Gerd Müller and others who were present for this particular conference. It's provoked quite a bit of a backlash as well among those who are still holding to a sort of strict neo-Darwinian view of things. We heard about Jerry Coyne's blog a little bit earlier on. But generally speaking, Perry, when it comes to this, I'm hearing lots of excitement from different angles. Just it's come up, you know, in conversation on recent editions of Unbelievable. We had Doug Axe, who's of course a colleague of Stephen, talking about the conference. He was there as well. And then in a recent edition of the programme, Wayne Rossiter, who has also published a book critical of the neo-Darwinian view, has been talking about the fact that this seems to represent a new front in scientific discovery. But as I've said, a lot of people think the most obvious route that this points towards is intelligent design of some kind. And I think a lot of people struggle to differentiate what you're talking about in your book from intelligent designers. And I think, as Stephen has put it quite well, you seem to agree to some extent on the DNA, the first sort of, you know, life first coming into existence seems to have a precursor in intelligent design. But he says, you know, at the end of the day, you can't get away from the inference to intelligence as well. With all of these mechanisms you're talking about, there has to be information put into the system in order for these to, even if it's kind of, you know, there in the cell, you know, and it's acting on some kind of algorithm that makes it respond to the environment around it. Someone's got to be putting the information in that makes that possible. In the end, I guess he's saying, Perry, you're just as much an intelligent design advocate as I am. So what's your response to that?
So the origin of information problem has not been solved. This is why I have a technology prize. And I think there's a key difference, though. I advocate intelligent design, lowercase I, lowercase d, in the broadest sense, that the universe is an amazing place and it speaks to something even more amazing than that, having created it. But again, I'm extremely reluctant to make God of the Gaps arguments. So how do you solve these problems, or what framework do you propose? Well, here's the framework that I propose. I propose that the cell is an agent. And there's a wonderful book by Bob Lanza called Biocentrism, which makes an extremely robust case that the universe is a consciousness-first, matter-second phenomenon, not the other way around. And I would like to suggest to the intelligent design community that if you want to defeat scientific reductionism, which I am agreement that needs to be done. Science is not reductionistic. Biology is not reductionistic. What you need to do is, instead of fighting evolution, fighting macroevolution, you need to embrace it, because what we don't know is how smart those cells really are. A bacterium can do more software engineering in 12 minutes than a team of Google engineers can do in 12 weeks. And this happens all the time in your body. It's why you have to finish your antibiotics, because if you don't kill those suckers dead, you're in real trouble. And I take the position I take because if I take the old school neo-Darwinist position, I will lose market share every year as more and more things turn out to be orderly instead of random. If I take the creationist or intelligent design Discovery Institute position, I will lose ground every year as they explain more and more evolutionary steps with observable processes. But if I take the third wave view, my market share will grow and grow, because the explanatory power of an integrationist, non-reductionist paradigm which also considers consciousness, it can in principle explain what's going on at the high level, but it gives a scientist something to actually do. So I'm making a prediction that over time, we are going to continue to explain more and more of the developments in taxa, from species to phyla and everything like that. And I think the next 20 years are going to be fantastic, and I think people in technology can learn a tremendous amount from biology.
It's always fun to hear you speak, Perry, because terms you use, the analogies often do come from both your technical background and your marketing background. But in any case, it's been great having you on the program. I'm going to finish up with Stephen now. Stephen Maher, thank you very much for being on the program today. I'm going to, by the way, post links from today's show to both of your websites and indeed to the posts that have come both from the Discovery Institute and from Perry himself with the different responses that you both had to what this particular conference meant. I mean, you've heard why Perry feels that in the end, intelligent design, which he sort of lumps in with creationism, doesn't offer a satisfactory overall explanation. For him, there's something about the nature of the universe, the way that everything is kind of done in such a way that these cells can have what almost their own consciousness, almost, it would appear. That doesn't sound like the route you particularly want to go down, Stephen. You seem to be saying, no, it's...
I think that's actually another form of intelligent design. He wants to attribute agency, conscious agency, in fact, an almost omniscient form of conscious agency to the bacterial cell itself. And so really the question is the locus of the intelligence. If you want to get information, you've got to have intelligence. Perry makes that argument very concisely in his discussion of the origin of life. He's applying it in an interesting way when you get to higher levels of biological evolution and imputing the intelligence to the biological cell or organism itself. But I have just a little thought experiment for your audience. I think most of us would agree that we're smarter than bacteria. But we in our conscious minds have no idea how to respond to various environmental stressors to rewrite our DNA to make to express different proteins under different circumstances. So if this isn't done by our conscious awareness, then there must be some pre-programming that is enabling the cell or the organism to do this. And I think that's what's really going on. And it's in fact, I think a lot of the experiments that have done already show that such pre-programming is present. In fact, that's what Shapiro himself says. So really the question is the origin of that pre-programming. I think it would be a mistake to impute higher consciousness to a bacterial cell. I think that would take us down the form of a kind of nature mysticism. And you don't need that in order to do exciting scientific research. We had a terrific scientific meeting the day after the Royal Society with all kinds of great research projects. Let me tell you about one that's relevant to cancer research. There's a problem in evolutionary theory known as the waiting times problem. And that is that you can actually quantify the number of coordinated mutations that are necessary to build certain types of structures. You can also quantify how long we should have to expect for those coordinated mutations to take place. And our ability to treat cancer actually exploits the cell's limits, its limits to evolve, its evolvability limits. Unhealthy cells are often treated by a cocktail of drugs that exploit the fact that cells can only produce so many coordinated mutations in a given amount of time. And so the kind of research we're doing, actually quantifying those waiting times, could be very useful in cancer research. And it's actually predicated on an understanding that there are limits to what evolutionary mechanisms can produce. And I think when we examine not only neo-Darwinism, but these third way mechanisms, we're seeing clear evidence of limits as well as capabilities. And so mapping where those boundary lines lie is a crucially important part of understanding what happened in the evolutionary past. But it's also crucially important to addressing disease in the present, like cancer and antibiotic resistance, both of which I think can be addressed by these drug cocktail approaches, which presuppose that there are limits to evolutionary change and what evolutionary mechanisms can produce. So I don't think this is a science stopper. I think that's a red herring. I think if you look at systems as design, there's lots of things to explore, including the functional logic, and that has led to a lot of cool discoveries. So I'm on the same page with Perry on neo-Darwinism. I think it's dead. I'm on the same page with him that there's a lot of elegant new mechanisms and new processes that are being discovered, but I don't think that the mechanisms that are being proposed by the third way folks solve the problem of macroevolution, and I don't think design is a science stopper. It's not only a good explanation of the informational properties of life and the informational infusions we see through the history of life, it also opens up a wide vista of new research projects, yeah. Some of which we're actually funding at the Discovery Institute.
Well, I was going to say that as much as you have obviously disagreed in certain respects with Perry, you both share that same view that neo-Darwinism is dead, and that scientism is also, you know, on the way out as well because of that.
Yeah, we share a lot, including a common metaphysical perspective, and I think where a lot of what's driving Perry is what he was talking about with market share. How do you position a more theistically oriented way of looking at the natural world to get people who are atheistic or agnostic to take you seriously? I think at the end of the day, you have to set those things aside and say, what is nature telling us? And then develop an understanding of both the origin and development of life that's consistent with the evidence.
Perry, just finally, obviously you may want to pick this up. I'm sure you will on your blog again once this conversation airs. But how long do you think it's going to actually take for the textbooks to catch up with where the actual science is? I mean, what kind of, do we kind of have to wait for the old guard to kind of pass away and these bright new young things like James Shapiro to be the ones writing these textbooks?
There's an old saying, science progresses one funeral at a time, and it's really true that a lot of times certain scientists have to die before new theories get a chance. And, you know, you might have been right a few years ago that the textbooks would be slow to catch up to this, but given the information age and the internet and the way things are, I think this will be fast, not slow. I think this will be like the Berlin Wall, where once it went down and once communism started tumbling, I think we're looking at 3 to 5 years before there's a complete paradigm shift, not only in inside the sciences, but in the pop culture.
Thank you both, Perry and Steve, for joining me on the program today. As I say, do check out the Unbelievable page in order to find links to both of their websites, their books, and the articles that have both come out with different responses from both camps to this is a very interesting Royal Society conference that took place at the end of last year. But for the moment, Perry and Steve, thanks for joining me on the program today.
Steve, really nice to meet you this way. I appreciate you coming and doing this and taking the time. It's really great.
Absolutely, Perry. It was fun. We met briefly at the conference itself, but this is a terrific discussion. And thanks for hosting, Justin. This is high-level stuff. Really good.
Well, it is high-level stuff, and we expect much from the Unbelievable audience. And, of course, if you're listening via podcast or online, you can always go back and revisit the bits where some things may have gone over your head. But I look forward to the kind of the interactions and feedback we get from the audience as well. So we'll be reading out some of those things that you've been saying about recent shows in the next part of today's programme. But for the moment, again, thanks, Steve and Perry.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As ever, you can get in touch by email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can leave a comment underneath today's programme at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Or you can get in touch via social media, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account, facebook.com to follow me on Facebook, @unbelievablejb to that as well. What use is intelligent design? A very appropriate subject given today's debate. That's the subject under discussion at the newly formed Sutton Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group. It's Dan Rogers, who's a friend of the show, who I think has been organising this. It's taking place in the High Street in Sutton at the Cock and Bull pub. That's 26 to 30 High Street, Sutton, on Monday, the 27th of February. One wag has suggested it's a very appropriate place, title, to be having a Christian and Skeptic discussion group, the Cock and Bull. But anyway, the Discovery Institute defines ID as a theory holding that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process, such as natural selection. Implicit in this definition is the assumption that the intelligent cause is not biologically related to and is ultimately responsible for the existence of all living things.
They're going to be looking at that with a 15 to 20 minute talk by Bruce Blackshaw, followed by a group discussion. So if you want to find out more about it, go to the meetup.com and you're looking for the Sutton Skeptic Christian Discussion Group, their latest event happening on Monday, February the 27th. Hope it goes well, whoever's going along to that particular group. Quick shout out to Joshua Blanchard, who tweeted me to say, any chance you could give me and my brother Ben Blanchard a shout out? I think you're both involved in science, specifically in Ben's case, ants, because he's asked me, could you answer this question? What is your favourite thing about ants? I'm collecting quotes. Well, if it helps you in any way, Benjamin, I think my favourite thing about ants is that they're great problem solvers. You know, you stick a rock or a log in front of them, they find a way around it. You know, they'll build a bridge, whatever. So I think it's the resourcefulness of ants that is my favourite thing about them. In other news, we've got some of your feedback to various editions of the programme recently. We're going to be talking in a moment about that episode with Frank Turek and David Smalley again. First of all, Ken in North Dakota says, I couldn't find an email, so I'm messaging you. Got in touch via Facebook to let you know I appreciate your weekly programme. I'm a former Christian college professor and taught philosophy and apologetics for 12 years, and so I'm familiar with most of the issues you deal with. However, I've never found anything that comes close to your ironic, open-minded, respectful and dialogical approach. I've listened to the podcast faithfully for several years, and so a bit late in thanking you, but it's a genuine one. I always try to emphasize to my apologetic students that the Christ-like spirit of engagement outlined in 1 Peter 3 is ultimately as important as the intellectual truth aspect of that passage, because being Christ-like mustn't be separated from the message of Christ. Thank you for modeling that Christ-like spirit for me and so many others who find ourselves struggling through the big and little questions of faith and life. I couldn't agree more, Ken, about the importance of living out the whole of 1 Peter 3:15. Thanks to Steve Surley, gets in touch about that Frank Turek, David Smalley edition of the programme. Frank Turek argues that atheists are stealing from God. Specifically in that edition of the show, they're stealing reason and logic to make their case against God. This debate was frustrating because Frank's question had a really obvious answer, but David wasn't interested in engaging with the question. The simple answer is that the laws of logic are founded upon tautologies that couldn't be anything other than what they are. Therefore, they cannot be invented, even by a God. They can only be thought about and given a name. Take the law of the excluded middle, for example. A statement can either be true or false. There is no middle ground. This isn't something that requires an explanation or a mind to invent it. This is a tautology. It's an obvious statement of fact that couldn't be anything other than what it is. If Frank's objection is that this statement requires somebody to have made it true, then what he's in effect implying is that there were other possible ways this law could have been. He's implying that God could have created a universe that didn't contain this law or contained a different law, but this is nonsense. What could a universe without the law of the excluded middle possibly look like? Frank is in effect suggesting God had to pick a set of tautologies for this universe, but tautologies cannot be picked. They only can be what they are. There is no alternative. Gabriel in the States says, I hope people take David's feedback towards Frank's book seriously. As far as the book is concerned, it seems fair that Frank is suggesting theft from the Christian God, not merely a God, though Frank did attempt to defend a more broad understanding of a mind. In that case, David was a bit sloppy towards the end when he stated explicitly logic and reason cannot exist outside human minds. In doing so, he seems to rule out the larger thrust of Frank's contention. In fact, we observe the laws of logic at work in the mind of most dogs as we see them follow a scent down the road and the road splits into a Y. Once the dog doesn't smell what it's after on one side, it immediately takes off running towards the other side. It doesn't smell the other side at all. It rules out from the two options that one road of the Y doesn't have the smell and the other will. Here's Tim in Saskatchewan, that's how you pronounce it, in Canada, says, I finished listening to the discussion between Turek and Smalley. I must say it was one of my favourite. I've been interested in the concept of presuppositional apologetics for a few years now, and I think Frank was able to extract the concept very well. Both guests were cordial yet forward, something that is sadly lacking in most intelligent conversations in our culture today. Sadly, though, I wish David could have been better prepared. Although Frank continued to bring about the concept that reason and logic derive from a source outside the human mind, David couldn't seem to grasp the concept and kept dodging off to non sequitur arguments. He seemed to think that because two atheists disagree on where logic and reason came from, they couldn't both be using the logic God created while denying his existence. It even got to the point that when David accused Frank of trying to trap him, when Frank simply used David's position to a logical outcome. I wish Frank could have pressed the point that if the immaterial substances are human concepts, then logic and reason would have to be subjective, like art and music. But because all people are able to have a rational conversation using the same standard of logic logic and reason, it would stand to reason that it's illogical for the concepts to be defined independently. I hope they can get together again in the future. I'm sure it'll be a great discussion. You also recommend a very well-read, articulate guest, Tyler Vaylor, a friend of Corey Markham from the Freedthinker podcast. Yes, I think I know Tyler a little bit via Facebook. Thanks for that suggestion, Tim. You also suggest Dr. Jason Lyle discussing his theory on anisotropic synchrony convention. Wow, I would be interested to find out what that is exactly, but you say here, showing that starlight millions of years away doesn't mean the universe is millions of years old. Okay, thank you very much for that suggestion. Thanks for all suggestions that come in. I do read them all. I can't always guarantee to read them all out, but I try and make a good stab at giving most of them an airing. Thanks for being in touch for this week's edition of the programme, Unbelievable. Don't forget to book in for Unbelievable the conference. If you're leaving it to the last minute, don't do that. You'll miss the early bird. premier.org.uk/whychrist. Hope to see you there on Saturday, the 13th of May. Really looking forward to this year's conference. Right now, our time is up, and I'm going to be handing over to myself again for the profile in a moment's time. My guest today, Becky Pippert, talking about her amazing work as an international evangelist. Let me tell you, though, what's coming up if you come back at the same time next week for Unbelievable. You're unbelievable. We've got a dialogue on Hinduism and Christianity next week. Was Jesus just another spiritual guru in the line of people like Krishna? Ken Samples from Reasons to Believe has a new book out called God Among the Sages. And he really does a compare and contrast between Jesus and all kinds of religious figures, Muhammad, Buddha, Krishna, and others, Confucius, for instance. Now, we've got a Hindu coming on. Deepan Rajagopalan of the Hindu Council is going to be with me, so hope you can join that as well for what should be a bit of a different conversation. Not an atheist this time, a Hindu in conversation with a Christian. Hope you enjoy it. Same time next week. Until then, have a very good week.